The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Cochran, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, April 3rd, 2025. We have six cases on our calendar today. Four are set for oral argument. This is the third of the four cases. This is A24-1342, Andrew Charles Patton versus State of Minnesota. These arguments are being held via Zoom and they are also being live streamed. A recording of these proceedings will be available to the parties after. However, no other recording is permitted unless there's permission by the court beforehand. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and that will be followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a square that has a clock, so please be mindful of your time. And if we do run into any technical difficulties, we will make sure to make any accommodations. Mr. Olson, appreciate you acknowledging that you do have noise in the background. So if that is an issue, we'll stop the clock and try to make whatever accommodations we can make. That being said, counsel for appellant, you may begin by stating your name for the record, the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this august court, I am Daniel Adkins, and I would say I rise, but given Zoom, I'm sitting, and I do apologize for the glare off my head. There's nothing I can do about that. I am representing Mr. Andrew Charles Patton in this matter. He is correctly characterized, Your Honors, as a petitioner and an appellant. There's sort of an unusual context where we have alleged sort of misconduct on the part of his trial counsel, but the primary purpose that we're here for is to request that this court overturn the denial of his effort to withdraw his guilty plea. It was timely filed. However, it was after sentence. As the court understands, there's a very different standard if you seek to withdraw your plea after the plea is entered, but prior to sentencing. In this instance, the sentence was pronounced in the spring, late spring of 2024. He did move to withdraw his plea with me as counsel in September. So there was a passage of time. The standard does change. I always like to start with the standard of this court's review. You do have a de novo look at what the Court of Appeals decided, and you get to review the evidence at the evidentiary hearing and in the trial court de novo. However, there is obviously a significant amount of deference, and the standard for review of the court's decision is manifest injustice, also characterized as I have to show that there was an abuse of discretion. And I'll start with this. Judge Ray, as you said in the previous argument, and I always like to cite back if I heard something very helpful, you mentioned that some of the decisions that may be before a court at any given time are non-precedential in nature. That is Mr. Patton's goal. We are not attempting to change the law in the state of Minnesota. The deference that this court must give to Judge Schefferdecker and to the court and to the parties, including a predecessor counsel of mine, is significant. It is substantial, but it is not endless. The court does not have to simply take as gospel or as law of the case what was stated in that courtroom. Abuse of discretion does mean that these courts, the court of this panel, doesn't have a ton of flips. You don't often change guilty plea acceptances that are being reviewed, but it does happen. And in this instance, Your Honor, we demand that you very carefully consider flipping this and permitting Mr. Patton an opportunity, not just for a trial, but for any significant meritorious review of his case. There was nothing done at the trial court at the very first appearance with counsel, with less than 45 minutes to consult with that attorney, the attorney that never visited him, that never made so much as a jail visit. Didn't even have a Zoom conversation. These were all text conversations, and there were some phone calls. The counsel had to admit at the trial court in the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Brawlick is his name, but it's not relevant, but his trial counsel didn't even wait until the discovery reached Mr. Patton. He did not see the evidence against him. He had to rely upon the summary that he was getting from this person hired by his girlfriend. He had
Mr. Atkins, I just want to clarify something that you're talking about now, and you mentioned at the beginning. I just want to clarify, you're not bringing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim here, correct?
Your Honor, we did assert ineffective assistance of counsel in the evidentiary hearing in the review. This is a direct appeal. My client has directed me to a direct appeal reviewing the judge's decision to deny the motion to withdraw. But what we did is we did create a record about the disconnect between trial counsel and his client and the utter disregard that his trial counsel had had for evidence that should have been available, should have been brought to the court. But what we're sort of trapped by the fact that the guilty plea was accepted. So the effectiveness of counsel isn't before this court in the way that it might be. But we are considered a petitioner and we're considered an appellant because the issues were sort of conglomerated. And the trial judge in the evidentiary hearing, that matter was resolved in October, I believe, if I've got my dates correct. In that evidentiary hearing, the judge did consider allegations that Mr. Brawley, trial counsel, was ineffective. So it's a little bit of a hybrid. And in answer to your question, I wish I had it more clear, but we are here considering.
But I do want to make sure that we're clear that you're not bringing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in this appeal.
I can't, Your Honor. I would have to be in a habeas setting for that. That may be available. What we were attempting to do is create some efficiencies. But what my client asked me to do, and the court asked the pertinent question, my client said, I just don't feel that the withdrawal of plea was handled fairly. So that motion process and the evidentiary hearing is before this court as a direct appeal. But I think the court can at least consider whether or not...
To be clear, you're appealing the denial of the motion to withdraw the plea.
That is correct, Your Honor. Yes.
And it seems to me, based on your brief, you make two arguments. One, that the plea was not voluntary, and two, that the plea was not intelligent.
That is exactly correct, Your Honor. That is right.
But kind of going back to the beginning of your argument where you discussed the standard of review, and I appreciate that because that, of course, is at the front of our minds and our analysis. You would agree, though, that we defer to the district court's credibility determination.
You must. And Your Honor, that is correct. And it makes sense. You obviously don't have evidence before you. We don't call witnesses here. However, the challenge that we've got is that the only witness that you would consider then is Mr. Patton himself. And what he testified to under oath was that he perjured himself. So the deference.
The district court did find that his testimony was not credible.
That the testimony that he gave in the evidentiary hearing, the court did find, and it would have to.
And so what, given that credibility determination or the determination that his testimony was not credible, what basis would there be for concluding that his plea was not voluntary? Because his whole argument that the plea was not voluntary was based on his testimony that he basically lied at the original hearing, the plea hearing, but the district court didn't find that credible. So, and the district court said, I think that he had a change of heart, was the way the district court put it. So given that, I mean, I know you have a separate argument about whether the plea was intelligent, but what basis would there be taking into account the district court's credibility determination to conclude that his plea was not voluntary?
Your Honor, if the deference was as all-encompassing as the court is at least alluding, there'd be no point in an appeal. What I'm suggesting this court can do is look at the entire record. The fact
and of course we will, but at the original plea hearing, he said he wasn't pleading guilty just to get out of jail, and he understood that that the court couldn't accept the plea if he was claiming he was innocent. And now at the hearing to withdraw his plea, he basically said, well, I was pleading guilty to get out of jail, and the district court didn't find that credible. So I'm not focusing, I mean, taking the record as a whole, I'm still having trouble understanding what support there is for your argument.
The testimony of Justin.
How the district court erred in its analysis.
Your Honor, I understand the question. The testimony of Justin Brawley is how you would decide that you will not, the deference to Judge Schefferdecker's decision isn't all encompassing. And frankly, it lacks weight. Justin Brawley admitted that he spent less than 45 minutes consulting with Mr. Patton prior to the entry of that plea. And again, that plea, the intent of that plea was to get out of jail, as Mr. Brawley was unable to say that it wasn't a conversation that he had. He didn't say he clarified that. It didn't even work. Mr. Patton stayed in jail. He stayed in custody. He didn't get to see a doctor, even after not only entering a plea, but carefully and with several stops and starts and a breakout for 20 minutes to get further advice. That was the hint to Judge Schefferdecker that there was not a meeting of the minds, that it was not a voluntary plea. He needed to be coached that carefully. If I could just briefly finish.
Yeah, Justice Pollack
said, I don't know why he pled guilty. That's what he testified to. That's in his testimony. What he was unable to do was to say for this court, for the reviewing court, that there was any confidence because Mr. Patton was poorly led. He was getting out of he had been in completely isolated insecurity when he was in the jail. I can't think of the term right now, but he was
solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement. Yes, Your Honor. All of those features came together. He's got one opportunity, first chance to be in court. He says, yes, I'm guilty because it's the only chance I've got to get out of custody. And it didn't even work. The entire record would verify that though he answered the question somewhat rotely in the courtroom, his conduct was inconsistent with that. He very clearly wanted to talk about. Yes, Your Honor.
With regard to his testimony about, his medical condition and being in confinement, there isn't a lot of detail there. Is there any case law to suggest that those types of conditions amount to improper pressure or coercion by the state?
Your Honor, on this, I would have to rely on my brief. I don't believe there are sort of a critical mass of decisions of that nature, but we did refer to a couple of the decisions that we believe it read in the right light. Would permit this court to reach a non-precedential conclusion, fact-specific to this case, that Mr. Patton was simply not given enough time, enough advice, and enough of an opportunity to test his theories, to talk to his counsel, a counsel that had seen the same discovery that he had. Your Honors, I want to make the point that the state had said, you can't let this plea be withdrawn. It's prejudicial. We will be put in a difficult situation. That's not the case. They've also argued that there were no defenses to worry about, the absence of a DRE, no concern. It is an issue. It is a basis for cases to get thrown out at an evidentiary level. The absence of a DRE to confirm the suspicions of an arresting officer, that needed to be given a full argument. That's all Mr. Patton wanted. The fact that he had an opportunity to consult with counsel and never was given that opportunity prior to the fact that it was characterized as a refusal. All of those, if the state is so strong in its evidence, what's the fear of actually having a meritorious evidentiary hearing or setting the case for trial? There is no prejudice to the state if this court finds that it was a guilty plea from the parking lot, Your Honor. Mr. Brawlick was hired. He had no intention of actually litigating this matter. He didn't read through it carefully. He didn't get a meeting of the minds with his client. He didn't speak to counsel. He didn't even verify whether there was going to be a release. He got an agreement, knowing that judge makes a point of not accepting those agreements. And that point, the judge explaining that over and over again to Mr. Patton, having Mr. Patton need to have a breakout, that should give this court pause. We're not talking about a single matter called with great care and authority in putting in the guilty plea. This is a rote calendar. This is pounding down cases and getting cases resolved. And Mr. Brawlick is doing what the court asked him to do. He's moving the matters off the calendar. That happened so quickly, Mr. Patton simply never had a chance to knowingly and intelligently confront the case against him. And that's the point that we're making. You lose nothing. The state loses nothing if this court decides that this plea was infirm because of the unique circumstances, the illnesses that he had suffered, the absence of a right and access to counsel, the fact that he had to be advised multiple times in both aspects, both in his guilty plea and the criminal case, and with respect to Morrissey and the probation matter. He had to keep being advised, no, this is okay. It doesn't matter that you don't understand what's going on. You want to get out, so we'll keep going.
Atkins, can you, with regard to the intelligence argument and your contention that he didn't understand what was going on, can you point us to what you think is the strongest evidence in that regard, or your best argument, or can you make your best argument in that regard? Because your time is limited here.
Understood. Thank you, Your Honor. I would have to point back to the testimony of an officer of the court. Justin Brawlick was unable to say that he was convinced that Mr. Patton had had all of his questions answered. Mr. Patton kept asking him in their phone conversation, as was his testimony and Mr. Brawley's. Well, when am I going to get a hearing? When am I going to see this evidence? When are we going to get to challenge it? And Mr. Brawley, at the very end of his last phone call, it's in his testimony in the evidentiary hearing, in the tail end of that phone call, he says, well, you don't have to worry about that. Well, there's a reason he didn't have to worry about it. It wasn't going to happen. It was being waived before it could have been radically considered. So the intelligence component, the fact that Mr. Patton had to be repeatedly assisted and advised and brought back in and given these breakout sessions, that amounts to the absence of scienter. That is the intelligence component that is completely lacking from his plea. And it means that he simply, you can tell what he's doing. He's trying to get out of jail. He's following the advice of counsel who has not even seen him, hasn't even made an opportunity to talk to him about what does your face look like? What does your tongue look like when you've been in custody for 25 days? It would matter because that was the primary reason the police believe this is our usual suspect. This is somebody we see and know. We know this clown. We're going to arrest this guy and we'll figure it out later. That was in the recording, Your Honor. That was in the cell phone that Mr. Patton was able to utilize to record all those conversations. They admitted the fact that we know this guy. We don't need much. We'll just get him down to the jail because everybody knows he's a user. And that's not enough, Your Honor. That usual suspect component combined with Mr. Brawley's completely peremptory actions and the fact that Mr. Patton had to be coached so cautiously and so thoughtfully.
Also, that almost sounds like a probable cause argument.
That's my point. There should have been an argument about whether the stop itself on the reasonable suspicion was legitimate. It absolutely, and I put this into our documents.
Then that seems to go to an ineffective assistance of counsel versus a plea withdrawal and whether or not it was intelligent or voluntary.
And you see why I have a hybrid motion before the court. The court is correct.
Well, it's a bit not a hybrid motion, though.
At the point where we are right now, the direct appeal, what I have to say is if you look at Brawley's advice, you have to find that was coherent and logical because it results in the decisions that Mr. Patton made. So from that perspective, disregard whether it was ineffective. Just tell us whether you have confidence that Mr. Patton knew what he was doing, I see my time has expired. I'll just finish this comment, that he understood what he was waiving and he did not. He had no idea that there'd never be a meritorious review, that all that would happen was he'd sit in jail for another week. I appreciate that, Your Honors, and I'll wait for my opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now turn to counsel for respondent state of Minnesota. You will have 15 minutes and the clock is set. Please state your name for the record, the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Members of the court, I am John Olson and currently serve as a Hubbard County attorney. For the record, when these matters were heard at the district court level, I served as an assistant county attorney under the then county attorney, Jonathan Frieden. So respondent Andrew Patton is now before this court, or petitioner respondent is now before this court, claiming the district court abused its discretion by denying his motion to withdraw a plea of guilty. And ultimately, he's now alleging that it was both not voluntary nor intelligent. And when we look at the underlying case, nothing is really unusual. We have a defendant who was stopped by police for what was a relatively minor traffic or equipment violation. And our law is pretty clear on that even the most minor of traffic violations or equipment violations is grounds for a stop. When police had contact with him, they viewed what they saw as signs of impairment. And under oath, at his plea hearing or sentencing hearing, Patton admitted there were signs of impairment as part of the plea colloquy. He was arrested, police obtained a search warrant, he refused, and like many other individuals, he was charged with DWI refusal. And even though he paid bail, there was a probation hold because he was on probation for a drug offense, and part of the violation was the new offense. Now, while in jail, he got an attorney, a deal was reached, he pled guilty, and similar to many other people, once they plead guilty, a DWI, it does not have unending incarceration. They're often released within so many days. And now out in jail, he is singing a different song and claims the plea must be vacated to correct a manifest injustice. And the district court rejected his petition. And a large part of the district court's findings was that Patton's testimony at the motion hearing was not credible. And the district court had very good reason for doing so. So the first issue, I think, separated out is the voluntariness and then separate whether the plea was intelligent. And with respect to the voluntary, it seems like there's just one key issue was he's now claiming that it was involuntary because he really just wanted to get out of jail. There was no other reason he did so.
Well, and also, now, I think he also testified that he was held in solitary confinement and had a medical issue that didn't get immediate attention. And I'm not sure that the district court found that testimony to be not credible. And maybe you can address that. But I guess more, my real question for you is, let me step back. I think the district court found him not to be credible, obviously made that finding, but I think that went more to his, you know, whether he was pleading guilty only to get out of jail. But there is this other testimony about the medical condition and being in solitary confinement. So assuming that testimony wasn't, the district court didn't find that testimony not to be credible, that the district court accepted that testimony. Is that testimony sufficient to demonstrate that the plea was involuntary as the result of improper pressure or coercion?
I don't believe so. I guess the district court's findings specifically said it is not credible. I guess it wasn't clear to what extent certain parts were deemed credible, certain parts were not. But A, the court had very good grounds to deem all his testimony not credible, because he said when he was asked later at the first at the original sentencing hearing, are you pleading guilty just to get out of jail? And he said no. And then later on at the motion hearing, about a year later, he says, I lied to the judge. At the original sentencing or plea hearing, he mentioned about a shooting incident, and that was more in relation to why did you refuse. He never said anything about being in solitary. He never said anything about medical issues. He never said anything about a break-in. And so, but now he says this later, when he obviously has a change of heart and wants to have his plea withdrawn. The key case on that issue about like medical treatment is the Perkins versus State decision. And he doesn't really put forth any specific, it's uncorroborated what these issues are. And it really doesn't say anything about why that prevented him from, how that rendered his plea involuntary. So I guess he hasn't met his burden in showing those issues make his plea involuntary. It was his obligation to do so. And even if that testimony was not considered not credible by the court, he didn't meet his burden in any of those issues. It wasn't met. It wasn't brought forth. Nothing was mentioned at the time of the plea hearing. And so, I just don't think, even if those issues were not deemed not credible, he didn't meet his burden.
Thank you.
And then, so the other issue then remaining is that his plea was not intelligent, and generally this is viewed as the defendant is aware of what the charges are, the rights they're waiving, and the consequences of the plea. And in here, we do have a written plea petition where he acknowledged he is waiving his right to right to a trial, his right to challenge evidence. He's also asked on the record by the court at the plea hearing a number of things, whether he had enough time to talk about the case. He knew the maximum penalty. He has satisfied his attorney's informed of the facts, investigation, read the complaint true and accurate, that he knows the rights to challenge evidence obtained by search and seizure, the right to contest its admissibility. And to all those questions, he answered yes. And there was also the issue of the court bringing up it would have to be supervised probation because he's already on supervision in another case. He had time to talk with his attorney about that, and he still agreed to move forward after the breakout room. And most importantly,
how do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that the attorney, Justin Brolik, his testimony at the evidentiary hearing shows that Patton did not understand and was unable to understand?
I don't think Attorney Brolik's testimony was he did not understand. It was, there was maybe a little bit of apprehension at first. He wanted to fight the charges, but once they discussed things more in depth, Attorney Brolik then read and explained to him he did not believe there was any legitimate stop challenges, any legitimate search seizure challenges. They might not have specifically discussed the expansion issue as a separate issue, but expressed that I don't believe there's any viable challenges. And then that Patton decided he just wants to get this done and over with. And this does happen, that once they meet with the attorney, they go over the evidence, they get that professional advice that maybe contrary to their own personal beliefs of what law enforcement's permitted to do, attorneys can say to their clients that, look, the standards of a stop are pretty low. The standards for expansion are pretty low. In fact, probable cause for arrest under DWI is a pretty low threshold for the state to prove. These stops, generally, these kind of challenges don't aren't effective very often, and therefore there's just not a lot there. And I think that's what happened. And then he kind of decided he just doesn't want to fight it anymore.
Just the limited amount of time that Mr. Patton and his counsel interacted, and the fact that Mr. Patton never viewed the discovery in person. It was just described to him over the phone, or at least that's my memory of the record. It just, does that suggest that his plea was not intelligent?
I'm not aware of any authority saying that a defendant for a plea to be intelligent, there has to be a face-to-face meeting. We do have Zoom court now. We do have a lot of telephone contact, and that is very common for that to occur. I'm not aware of any authority that an attorney alone can't look at discovery. The defendant himself has to look at the discovery himself for a plea to be intelligent. We do have all kinds of authority that attorneys are the professionals. They are the ones who kind of generally make the decisions on what challenges are made, whether there's viable challenges, and the record supports that this is really what occurred, although he left it up to Patton to make the final decision whether to make such a challenge, and he chose not to. And so, and I think one thing in particular is when he was asked at the sentencing hearing if his attorney, Justin Brawlick, answered all the questions, Patton did not just answer in the affirmative. He specifically said, "Very well, sir." He gave his attorney more than just he did his job. He did it very well. And then at the motion hearing seeking to withdraw his plea, he now says, "I lied to him." Meaning he lied to the trial court judge when he answered that. And so the record shows that Mr. Brawlick had a lawyer, Mr. Patton had a lawyer. They were able to discuss the reports. They were able to discuss the evidence. He was able to meet with his client and advised that there's no search and seizures. And I think a lot of the argument raised by Mr. Patton now are that it could not be intelligent because he waived viable challenges, but nothing in the record supports that there's viable challenges. There's been no authority that these challenges could have been successful. There's nothing to suggest that only when there's a DRE can a expansion on a stop for DWI investigations can that occur. We have authority that it's not required. That case is unpublished. It's cited in our brief. But altogether, these DWIs are a very simple case. This was not a criminal sexual conduct case or a murder. These DWIs are very simple and they contain very few elements. In a refusal case, under our current precedent, it's largely, was this person driving? Was there a search warrant for a blood or urine sample? And what did they refuse? And then, of course, the venue element, there is very little to prove in these cases. It's a misdemeanor offense and it's not very complicated. So I don't think extensive communication or even putting a rule in place that a certain amount of time is necessary is what's necessary here. The court made detailed findings about everything that the plea there was.
But if there is, I understand your point that these are simple cases, but if there is evidence that the cops said, put them in the, let's just detain them, arrest them, and we'll figure it out later. Like, that's a pretty serious challenge that could be brought up on a probable cause dismissal.
Well, right now we're assessing whether the plea was voluntary and intelligent at the time it was entered, and that was not in existence apparently at the time. His attorney didn't know about it, and even Mr. Patton didn't know what might have been said or unsaid at the time. And what's more important is that's not in the record. That recording is not in the record in this case, so I don't think it can properly be considered. That would be newly discovered evidence and would have to be brought about before separate proceedings, and I think that's what the court ruled. any newly discovered evidence would have to be a separate proceeding. So I don't think it's properly considered here. Sorry.
That'd be a new post-conviction where that would have to be raised.
There would have to be a separate based on newly discovered evidence and then introduced in the record. And so based on the totality of what happened, the great deference given to the district court, the state is asking that the district court's decision be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. And I do not see any other questions, so we will turn back to appellant. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. We'll get that set here in just a second. There we go, and you may begin.
Thank you, Judge Reyes, and I apologize. I'm right on a train yard, so there may be a little bit of a loud noise on my shoulder. But you said Mr. Olson could have construction. I'm a little bit stunned. It sounds like we don't even need a defendant. The lawyer can do it all, could just mail in the petition. And we're not talking about a misdemeanor. We're talking about a gross misdemeanor. It's a third degree because of the refusal. There are protections. They still matter. Counsel just said these are low standards that a prosecutor has to meet. Apparently, they're low and getting lower. The challenge here is you have to look at what happened from the context of I'm not suggesting that the absence of a DRE means he's going to walk in and get the case dismissed, but it is a major consideration when a trial court is considering whether or not there's reasonable suspicion for a stop or probable cause to expand the search and to continue with this gross misdemeanor up to a year in jail. As the judge is considering whether that's appropriate, whether or not someone who's an expert who can do far more than just look at bumps on a tongue or listen to responses, he can actually or she can actually tell you this person is under the influence of drugs. It's much tougher than alcohol. Alcohol is fairly straightforward. Counsel's right about that. But when you're talking about somebody who has a 0.000 on a BAC, on a preliminary breath test, it gets a little more complex and it gets more assessment. I can tell you, I spend a lot of time in trial court. I spend a lot of time in evidentiary hearings, and I have a lot of success at convincing judges that these prosecutions are not properly based, that the officers have made too many shortcuts, or that, as the recording would indicate, they're not even paying attention. They've got the right guy. They don't care anymore.
With regard to the recording, though, that wasn't in the record at the time of the plea.
We're only able to
discover it after. And so that's not part of. And it wasn't. Would you agree then that it's not part of the record in terms of our consideration about whether the plea was manifest, whether there was manifest injustice?
It's not directly relevant to the manifest injustice aspects of this, but the court did know that it existed in the context of our motion to withdraw the plea. So in that unusual jurisdictional window that we're in, the court did understand that new evidence was available. And of course, they admonished me the same way that Judge Reyes did at the beginning. There is an opportunity here for a
piece. And that's what I was just going to say. There would be, based on that, an opportunity to file a petition for post-conviction relief for ineffective assistance of counsel.
100% correct, Your Honor. And that may be a conversation for another day, but I think it has relevance here in this context. Mr. Patton was being prosecuted. He was being handled like the usual suspect. That he felt like, I've got no choices here. I've got to follow this lawyer's advice over the phone and via text. He sent him three different plea petitions, each one with significant changes. My client signed all three of those, sent those back to Mr. Brolic, and even in one case, gave it to the deputy, and he took it to the court, and it was filed into the case. Those plea petitions were, I'm leaving, no further jail, no executed jail, no further jail, and none of those came true. He was trying with all of his heart, with all of his being, to try to get out of custody by a guilty plea that was infirm. That's our point, Your Honor.
But he had been told, he had been informed by his attorney that ultimately it was still up to the district court in terms of whether or not he would have any additional jail time, though, correct?
Only in the interim between pleading guilty, giving up his rights, realizing he would never have a hearing, and then finding the judge was going to move immediately to a Morrissey hearing and consider whether or not to let him go based on what was already holding him in custody. Again, he'd already posted bail, but that was pointless. That money was literally wasted. But the court asked a good point. At that point, he goes, what do you mean I'm not leaving? Well, you're going to have to hear this, and the judge doesn't have to accept our agreement. Just out of spite, out of whatever, the judge says, no, I'm going to get another sanction out of you. And he had to have that, again, another breakout to say the judge has the right to do that. But you could have a hearing in a week. You could come back in a week and maybe get more time.
Well, of course, at the plea hearing, though, the court did.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
I was just going to ask if It's my understanding at the he signed the plea petition, and at the plea hearing, the court did go over the petition and the waiver of his rights. Is that correct?
The court did that, and he perjured himself. And my point I want to make, counsel rushed right past this. Perjury matters. Perjury matters for witnesses for the state, and it matters when the defendant perjures himself. It matters very significantly. If he's willing to tell you that he was only telling the truth because he felt pressured or he felt coerced or he felt that this was his only opportunity, it matters. The court can find that that portion of his testimony or some portion was not credible. But the fact that the defendant took the oath and said, I was lying, it just matters. It matters for this court. You can find with non-precedential aspects that in this unique setting, this was too quick. This was simply not the sort of guilty plea that we want the state of Minnesota to utilize going forward. We want more process than this. And I note that my time has ended. I'll answer any remaining questions.
Do not see any other questions.
Appreciate the court's time. Thank you, folks.
Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. It's very well done. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.
Good to see you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.